From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Jesselyn Radak, and I'm a former Department of Justice attorney who became a whistleblower in the case of American Taliban John Walker Lind. I have been retaliated against for the past 3 years, including being forced out of my Justice Department job, fired from my subsequent law firm job at the government's urging, placed under a criminal investigation that was closed with no charges ever being brought, put on the no-fly list, and referred to the state bars in which I am licensed as an attorney. So when Judge Chertoff says that he's committed to civil liberties, I seriously question that.
We'll speak with a Justice Department whistleblower who alleges misconduct by justice officials and the prosecution of John Walker Lind. Her charges include President Bush's nominee to head the Department of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff. But first, as some of the world's richest countries agree to temporarily freeze debt repayments of countries hit by the tsunami, we'll speak with globalization expert Norina Hertz, author of The Debt Threat, How Debt is Destroying the Developing World. And we'll look at extreme weather in California. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has publicly admitted that the hunt for weapons of mass destruction has ended in Iraq. After a nearly two-year search, no stockpiles of nuclear, chemical, biological weapons were found. The search actually ended before Christmas, but the Bush administration was silent on the issue until Wednesday, following the publication of a front-page report in The Washington Post. The Bush administration repeatedly cited Saddam Hussein's stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction as the main reason for going to war. 2 days before the March 2003 invasion, Bush told the nation, quote, "The Iraq regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised." Pressed by reporters on Wednesday, the White House maintained the invasion of Iraq was justified even though no such weapons were ever found. In other news from Iraq, the Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration is considerably lowering its expectations for both the turnout and the results of the January 30th election in Iraq. Officials are now claiming high voter turnout is not even significant. A senior administration official said, quote, "I would really encourage people not to focus on the numbers, which in themselves don't have any meaning, but to look on the outcome and to look at the government that will be the product of these elections." The comment came during an official White House briefing, but reporters were barred from citing what official conducted the briefing. Also Wednesday, the White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan admitted, quote, "The election is not going to be perfect." Earlier this week, interim Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi said for the first time elections would not be held in all parts of Iraq. Meanwhile, violence continued today across Iraq. An aide to the country's top Shia cleric was assassinated along with four bodyguards and his son. The sheikh was the official representative of the Ayatollah Ali Sistani in the town of Salman Pak. Meanwhile, gunmen killed six people outside a Baghdad hotel. A Turkish businessman was also abducted. And in Mosul, twin car bombings have killed two Iraqi soldiers. The New York Times is reporting the White House urged Republican lawmakers last month to scrap a legislative measure that would have imposed new restrictions on the use of extreme interrogation measures by CIA officers. The Senate had approved the new restrictions by a 96-2 vote as part of the intelligence reform legislation. But in closed-door negotiations, congressional officials deleted the restrictions from the final bill after the White House expressed opposition. One congressional Democrat told the Times that the White House stance had left the impression, quote, that the administration wanted an escape hatch to preserve the option of using torture against prisoners held by the CIA. In a pair of decisions, the Supreme Court has ruled that federal sentencing guidelines put in place two decades ago are unconstitutional because they violate a defendant's right to be tried by a jury. The court ruled judges cannot increase sentences beyond the maximum that the jury's findings alone would support. Although tens of thousands of federal prisoners are serving time based on the now unconstitutional guidelines, the court ruled the decision is not retroactive. With the sentencing guidelines thrown out, judges will, for now, have more discretion in sentencing. But the Wall Street Journal reports the end result may be harsher prison sentences. The Republican-led Congress is expected to now seek to reassert legislative control by pushing through aggressive mandatory sentences. The Department of Justice has already begun discussing how to set such rules without violating the Constitution. In other Supreme Court news, justices ruled the government can deport people without getting the permission of the country of destination. In Bolivia, massive protests in the city of El Alto have forced the government to announce it will cancel a contract with a French utility company that provides water to the city. The protesters accuse the French company of charging excessive rates. The water protests come almost 5 years after similar protests began in the Bolivian city of Cochabamba. In that city, the popular revolt led to the ouster of Bechtel Corporation as the provider of the city's water utilities. As the water protests have been taking place in El Alto, hundreds of thousands of Bolivians elsewhere in the country have taken to the streets to protest a government plan to raise gasoline prices. In other news from Latin America, Colombia's defense minister acknowledged Wednesday that the government had paid a bounty hunter to seize a member of FARC while he was in the Venezuelan capital of Caracas. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has described the December 13th as a kidnapping that violated his country's sovereignty. Until now, the Colombian government had claimed the man, Rodrigo Granda, was captured inside Colombia along the Venezuelan border. In business news, the stock value of stun gun manufacturer has plunged over 40% this month, in part because the Securities and Exchange Commission had announced it's investigating the safety of the guns. Tasers are marketed as a non-lethal weapon, but at least 80 people have died in the U.S. after being tasered. The SEC is also investigating possible insider trading by taser company officials. In news from Haiti, evidence is emerging that the country's interim justice minister is forcing judges to resign who've ordered the release of supporters of Jean-Bertrand Aristide from prison. Since Aristide was overthrown in a coup in February, hundreds of supporters have been jailed. One of the most prominent supporters is the Catholic priest Gerard Jean-Just, who was released in November. On Monday, the judge who ordered his release resigned, citing government interference. Meanwhile, the Caribbean community bloc, CARICOM, reiterated Wednesday it will not recognize the acting government of Haiti until elections are held and democracy is restored to the country. Aristide was the country's first democratically elected president. In news from Capitol Hill, Senator Edward Kennedy called on the Democratic Party to adopt a more progressive agenda. He said, quote, "We cannot become Republican clones. If we do, we will lose again and deserve to lose." He called on Medicare to be gradually expanded to cover all citizens and for greater federal support for college costs. Kennedy also accused President Bush of exaggerating the problems of Social Security in a similar way as he did the threat posed by Iraq. The son of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher pled guilty today. Margaret Thatcher's son, Mark Thatcher, pled guilty in court for his role in trying to overthrow the government of the West African nation of Equatorial Guinea. Sir Mark Thatcher helped finance a helicopter used in the failed coup attempt. He maintains, however, he had no foreknowledge of the coup. He's been fined $500,000 and received a 4-year suspended jail sentence. In Britain, a photograph has been published of Prince Harry wearing a Nazi uniform at a costume party held last week. Harry's the youngest son of Prince Charles. The 20-year-old apologized last night, saying it was a poor choice of costume. The Guardian reports the episode served to stir ugly memories of the royal family's links with the Nazi regime. King Edward VIII, Harry's great-great uncle was a Nazi sympathizer, while Princess Michael of Kent's father was a Nazi party member. The scandal comes just 2 weeks before the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, the Nazi concentration camp where more than a million Jews were murdered. And finally, the widow of musical legend Bob Marley announced Wednesday she's planning to exhume his remains in Jamaica and rebury them in Ethiopia. Rita Marley described Ethiopia as Bob Marley's, quote, spiritual resting place. The announcement comes just weeks before what would have been Bob Marley's 60th birthday. He was born on February 6, 1945, in St. Anne, Jamaica. He died in 1981 at the age of 36.
Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they keep...
Redemption song, Bob Marley, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. Well, the Paris Club of Rich Creditor Nations reached an agreement on Wednesday to temporarily freeze debt repayments of countries hit by last month's tsunami to help them recover. Club President Jean-Pierre Jouyet told a news conference that the suspension of debt would not be subjected to any of the conditions that usually accompany aid, such as an accord with the International Monetary Fund or private creditors. According to the World Bank, the affected nations owe hundreds of billions in debt. Indonesia owes $132 billion. India owes just over $100 billion. Thailand owes $60 billion. And Malaysia owes $50 billion.
So far, only Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and the Seychelles have signaled they will take up the offer. Other tsunami-affected countries such as India, Malaysia, and Thailand have not requested a freeze on their debt repayments. British aid agency Oxfam was critical of the Paris Club offer. They said in a statement, quote, rather than agreeing to cancel significant portions of the debt, they seem set to go for the easy option of a temporary suspension of repayments, which will then be reapplied in a few months. The Paris Club is made up of an informal group of the world's richest creditor nations, including Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Russia, and the United States. It meets about 10 times a year to discuss debts owed to them. Joining us right now from Washington, D.C. is Nerina Hertz. She is Associate Director of the Center for International Business at the University of Cambridge, one of the leading experts on economic globalization. Her latest book is called The Debt Threat: How Debt is Destroying the Developing World and Threatening Us All. Nerina Hertz, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's very good to have you with us. Well, what is your response to the offer of the industrialized world?
Well, yet again, something is on the table that on face value seems good. But in practice, what does it mean? It means that countries, you know, who have been terribly afflicted by the tsunami are now going to see debt service repayments halted, but only for a few months. They're going to be charged interest in the interim, and in a few months' time, we'll have a big bill to pay This isn't really justice for countries terribly in need.
In terms of the impact of this debt on many of the countries that are affected by the tsunami, for instance, can you give us an idea of the proportion of their overall budgets that are now dedicated to paying off international debt as opposed to being able to deal with the problems of their own countries?
Yes. I mean, if you take Indonesia, for example, Indonesia spent a quarter of its government revenues last year on debt service. But we need to think kind of bigger than just the Asian tsunami-afflicted countries, because of course what is good for Sri Lanka must also be good for Sierra Leone. An African life must be valued as highly as an Asian life. And African countries are facing tragedies in terms of human lives on a daily basis, and they're not getting their debts cancelled.
Can you talk about what it means to pay the debt? Can you talk about how the whole process works?
Well, what happens is that the world's poorest countries, if you look at sub-Saharan Africa, for example, it is paying out $30 million every single day on debt service. This is a region where 26 million people are HIV/AIDS infected, where 40 million children will lose a parent to HIV/AIDS within the next 10 years. Yet this region is having to pay out four times what it can afford to spend on healthcare on debt service. The rich countries of the world, the World Bank and the IMF, are insisting that they are put before lives, before education, before basic human needs.
Well, of course, the creditor nations insist that if they were to cancel all of this debt, that there'd be international financial problems. However, Argentina clearly canceled or at least put a moratorium on its debt several years ago, and the sky has not fallen in. In fact, things have begun to improve in Argentina to some degree. Could you talk about the response of the creditor nations to this issue of debt mitigation?
Well, you're absolutely right, Juan. I mean, Argentina said to the international community, you know what, we're not going to put our people's needs before your rich countries' banks' wants and wishes. We're going to look after our people first. And so they suspended all repayments on $100 billion worth of debt and have done fantastically well as a consequence. Over the past 2 years, growth rates have shot up, unemployment is being slashed, and they have got a very, very strong position moving forward. And what we might see, I think, are more countries looking at the Argentinian example and saying, you know what, why are we putting the needs of our people behind those of the World Bank and the IMF? Perhaps we should also strategically decide not to repay our debts.
We're talking to Norina Hertz. Her book is called The Debt Threat, How Debt is Destroying the Developing World and Threatening Us All. She's a professor at the University of Cambridge in Britain. In this offer that the Paris Club of Rich Creditor Nations has made to temporarily freeze debt repayments to tsunami-hit countries, only Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and the Seychelles have said they'll take up the offer. India, Malaysia, Thailand have not requested a freeze on their debt payments. Why? What's the difference in this response?
Well, I think what is good is that what we don't have is the traditional one-size-fits-all solution imposed upon developing countries. I think it's good that countries are given a choice whether or not to have their debts cancelled at this stage. And for some countries, some of the more advanced developing countries, actually, it's better for them to go and borrow money on the international capital markets in order to get investment that they need. And they're worried, those countries, that if they accept this debt cancellation deal, that they're going to be penalized by lenders. And that's why they're deciding not to do it. But to go back to your question, Juan, about whether if we cancel debts, we're actually encouraging countries to run up kind of new bills in the future. I think we often forget how complicit we in the developed world are in the mess that the developing world finds itself in. Because, of course, we lent monies to the world's poorest countries, not so that they could develop and improve their circumstances, but really, especially during the Cold War, to serve our own geopolitical interests. And if you look at a country like the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly Zaire, the United States, for example, lent half of the loans it gave to Africa in the 70s to one of the most notoriously corrupt and tyrannical dictators in the world, President Mobutu, who they knew was using the money to charter Concorde for his private shopping sprees, or buy estates and castles all over Europe. And, you know, Indonesia, Suharto, Abacha, Nigeria, Marcos, the Philippines, Saddam Hussein, of course, of Iraq, we lent to terrible, tyrannical dictators who we knew weren't going to use the money for their people, and yet those people are being asked to repay the debts today.
We're talking to Norina Hertz. The Debt Threat is her book, How Debt is Destroying the Developing World and Threatening Us All. She's speaking to us from Washington, where there's a Jubilee conference going on, and we're going to return to her in a minute. Then we'll be speaking with a Justice Department whistleblower. She says the Department of Homeland Security Secretary nominee, Michael Chertoff, and others, she has serious questions about what they did around the case of John Walker Lynn. And we're going to be talking about extreme weather in California with British columnist George Mambio. Stay with us. For me, Cat Power, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, on NPR stations, public access TV, and PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, Dish Networks Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org. We are also, our TV programs are closed captioned, so that the deaf and hard of hearing can access Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Norina Hertz, who joins us from Washington, D.C. studio, where she's come in from Britain to attend a Jubilee conference. Her book is called The Debt Threat. Juan?
I'd like to ask you, in your book, you talk about a particularly pernicious type of debt predator. You call them debt vultures. Could you talk to our audience about what are debt vultures and give us some examples of them?
Sure, Juan. Debt vultures are really the scum at the bottom of the pond. These are guys who buy up the debts of the world's poorest countries on the secondary market. You can go and buy debts of a country like Peru, for example, at a real discount. Why? Because people think that the debts won't be repaid. So you can buy Peruvian debt worth a dollar for 10 cents, for example. And what these guys do is they buy up lots and lots of this debt at this big discount, and then they go to the country in question and they say, we are going to sue you unless you repay your debts at face value. So in the case of Peru, for example, there's a firm of debt vouchers called Elliott Associates, and they went and they bought up all this Peruvian debt for about $10 billion. And then they went to the government and they said, we want to get it back at face value, which was about $56 million.
And so and in this the process, Elliott Associates, this Elliott Associates is based in New York City?
It sure is, but we've got awful debt vouchers in my hometown in London too, so it's not just a US phenomenon. But what they do is then they, you know, for the people of Peru, this is school books and medicines that the children there are therefore unable to get. And I met some of these debt vouchers recently, and it was just after the hurricane had taken place in Cuba, and they'd been buying up Cuban debt. And I said, God, you know, the hurricane, how awful it was for the people. And all they said to me was, the people, hey, we don't care about the people. We're just worried about what that would do for the price of debt. Capital, they said to me, Narina, has no soul.
We're talking to Narina Hertz. She's author of The Debt Threat, a professor at the University of Cambridge in Britain. And we're talking about the debt and as it relates to the tsunami. You talked about countries giving money to dictators like Suharto, the old dictator of Indonesia, knowing that these leaders are going to take much of that money. And yet it's the people who remain long beyond the reins of these dictators that have to pay back. What do you think is the solution? You're in Washington. You can tell us about the conference. But would you say that countries should simply refuse to pay back debt?
Well, I think in the case of Latin America and more developed countries, that actually is an option. Countries could band together. And in Latin America now, we do have a whole group of left-leaning governments. There is consensus amongst Venezuela, Uruguay, Brazil. Argentina's doing great. And there would be a case, I think, for a strategic default. In the case of Africa, it's more complicated because African countries are actually paying back for every dollar that they receive in aid, approximately the same amount in debt service. So they're much more kind of linked, and they're really, really dependent, though, on aid coming in. And were they to default, all aid from the World Bank and IMF would freeze immediately. So they've got a more difficult challenge ahead of them. But I think we've got to be really clear on this. Countries that need monies so that they can provide healthcare and education and shelter to their people shouldn't have to repay debts that we knowingly lent to bad regimes long since gone. And all illegitimate debts, the debts lent to these terrible dictators like Saddam Hussein, like Suharto, like Marcos, must also be cancelled. But I think, and we're running an email campaign on www.debtthreat.com, where people can send an e-letter to President Bush saying, we want debts to be cancelled, and we also want you to make sure that the money saved do go to health and education and infrastructure so that they do reach the poor and needy and vulnerable in the countries in question.
Do you think that some of these third world countries don't realize the negotiating power that they do have? I remember a businessman I once interviewed quite extensively about some of these issues told me, well, Juan, you know, if you borrow $1,000 from a bank and you can't pay back, you're in trouble. But if you borrow $100 million from a bank and you can't pay back, the bank's in trouble. That you usually are in a better negotiating position when you owe a lot of money than when you owe a little bit of money.
Yeah, and that's why I think in the case of Latin America, we really may see a collective default, because I think especially looking at the Argentinian success. In the case of Africa, I think there's less perhaps unanimity amongst governments, and I think there's less chance that we're going to see this kind of collective decision. But you're absolutely right, Juan. I mean, when you owe a lot of money, you've got power. And the developing world really needs to exercise this power. But they did do it in the case of the trade talks in Cancun, of course, last year, when for the first time we did see this kind of collective bargaining on the part of Brazil and China and India and a whole host of developing countries turning around to the West and saying, we don't accept the rules that you are laying out. We are not going to sit at the table when you're defining the rules. We would rather walk away. And this kind of collective action is was pretty much unprecedented in recent times. So perhaps we'll see more collective action around debt. But until that point, we, the creditors, we in the West, need to take responsibility for our part in this situation and cancel the debt. And you know what? It wouldn't actually cost that much. If we were to cancel all the debt of sub-Saharan Africa, that would amount to $170 billion, which sounds like a lot, but it's actually the cost of US military operations in Iraq so far. It's not a matter of available resources, it's a matter of what we choose to do with them.
Well, Narina Hertz, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Among the more remarkable quotes and figures in your book, The Death Threat, again, on the issue of sub-Saharan Africa, some 15,000 children die every day from poverty-related diseases, yet still the governments are required to pay out some $30 million every day to the World Bank, IMF, and rich world creditor nations. Every $1 that's given to that region in aid, $1.50 goes out to cover debt repayments. Narina Hertz, thanks for joining us, author of The Debt Threat. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, residents of the coastal town of La Conchita are warned that the steep hills overlooking their community could collapse again as the death toll from Monday's mudslides rose to 10, with three still missing. Rescue workers are still searching for any survivors who may remain trapped in the 30-foot deep mound of earth that swallowed some 15 homes in La Conchita, which lies about 80 miles north of Los Angeles.
Part of a hillside that towered over the seaside enclave collapsed 2 days ago after weeks of drenching rain unleashed torrents of mud that buried a four-block area within seconds. Video of the mudslide showed a large portion of a towering bluff break off and then rumble down the hill toward the town, carrying trees, power lines, and thick mud into homes below. Several cars were crushed, and a bus was tossed into one of the homes. On a visit to the area, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger told reporters, quote, we've seen the power of nature to cause damage and despair, but we'll match that power with our own resolve. Authorities blame the landslides and flooding on 5 days of heavy rain, which have resulted in some 20 deaths in the state. Southern California has had a total of 17 inches of rain in the past 2 weeks. We go now to George Mambio. He is author and columnist for the London Guardian. His latest book is Manifesto for a New World Order. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks very much, Amy.
Well, can you talk about the extreme weather we're seeing in the California area? And then we want to talk to you a little about the tsunami.
Sure. It seems very clear that the sort of weather you're seeing in California ties in with the predictions made by climate scientists for what would happen under a climate change scenario. Now, no one can put their hand on their heart and saying that and say that any one weather event is the result of climate change. What we can say is that weather events like this are in line with the predictions made by climate scientists for what would happen when climate change begins to accelerate. And what they say is that we're likely to see far more events of this nature, far more freak weather, far more hurricanes, far more storms, far greater precipitation, rainfall at certain times of the year, stronger winds, and all the rest of it. And the frightening thing to remember is this, that so far, as a result of human activities, we've seen a global warming of 0.6 degrees centigrade. But what climate scientists are talking about is a possible global warming under their maximum scenario of 6 degrees centigrade by the end of this century. In other words, 10 times as much warming as we've seen so far. And if the disruptive weather, which we've suffered so far in many parts of the world, we're having something very similar here in the United Kingdom at the moment, if the disruptive weather like that results from just 0.6 degrees, think of what the consequences of 6 degrees would be.
In terms of the reality that the Bush administration now is increasingly totally isolated from the rest of the world on this issue, what hope do you see over the next 4 years for the world community being able to more properly address the issues of global warming?
Well, you're absolutely right, Juan, to say that Bush really is isolated at the moment, as far as the world is concerned, that the great majority of developed countries have signed up to the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, which is an attempt to get the rich countries together to try to limit their own carbon emissions. And the United States is one of the very few which has not signed up. And now the Bush administration, just in the past few weeks, has tried to prevent any extension of the Kyoto Protocol. There was an attempt to have a new treaty which would come into force in 2012, which would bring about much bigger cuts in carbon dioxide and which would try to pull in the developing countries such as India and China. And the Bush administration, even though it didn't have negotiating rights because it hadn't signed the Kyoto Protocol, it deliberately disrupted and destroyed that meeting so that so far there is no agreement for what's going to happen from 2012 onwards. So it's not just that Bush has withdrawn from global agreements and global attempts to do something about this problem, he's actually quite deliberately gone about to try to destroy those attempts and try to destroy any agreements to sort out climate change. And so when Schwarzenegger talks about matching the scale of nature with the scale of our resolve, well, he's certainly not talking the same language as Bush is talking, and even the language which Schwarzenegger is using is unmatched by his own involvement in trying to do anything serious about climate change. And we've seen how he's really given drivers in particular a very easy ride, how the efforts which should be being made, particularly to get people out of sports utility vehicles, are simply not being made either by Schwarzenegger or, of course, by Bush. Now, what we need to do is to campaign constantly to make sure that the Bush administration, like governments all over the world, begins to take climate change as seriously as they take terrorism. Because when it comes to the numbers of people who are likely to be affected by climate change, that outweighs by many times the number of people who, even under the worst-case scenario, could be affected by terrorism. Climate change is actually a far greater threat to human well-being than terrorism is.
Finally, George Monbiot, on the issue of the tsunami, you have a column called Killing Versus Helping. Very briefly, explain.
Yes, the United States government has quite generously given $350 million to the victims of the tsunami, or at least promised that money to the victims of tsunami in Asia. But that is a drop in the ocean. It's the equivalent of 1.5 days of its spending in Iraq. It's so far spent $148 billion there. And it seems to me to be a commentary on the fundamental sickness at the heart of government, that we always find enough money for killing people, and we always struggle to find enough money for helping people. And if the Bush administration really had had humanity at heart and really was concerned about the people of the developing world, the $148 billion it is spent in Iraq on clearing people out of cities like Fallujah, on killing possibly tens of thousands of civilians, that money would have been spent on humanitarian aid for the very poor.
George Monbiot, we want to thank you very much for being with us. George Monbiot is a columnist in Britain with the Guardian newspaper. We thank you. This is Democracy Now. Thank you. And when we return, we will speak with the Justice Department whistleblower. Stay with us.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV, and seen all the kids in the soda pop bands, but none of them look like me. So I started looking around for a light out of the dim. my feet. You don't understand. Sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes. And I believe God is great. All praise due to him. And if I should die, I rise up to the sky just like Jesus. Peace be upon him. I shall do. La 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 la. There's no God but God.
Steve Earle, John Walker's Blues, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Michael Chertoff, President Bush's Homeland Security chief nominee, was praised by Senate Democrats and state lawyers this week as being a tough but fair prosecutor who would serve well as Tom Ridge's replacement. But his record comes under fresh scrutiny. Questions are being raised about his handling of the case of John Walker Lynn, the so-called American Taliban. As head of the criminal division of the Justice Department, Chertoff's prosecution of Lynn in 2002 was his biggest triumph. But the case resurfaced the following year in Senate confirmation hearings after Chertoff was nominated to be a federal appellate judge. At that time, Senate Democrats questioned Chertoff extensively about concerns that the FBI might have improperly questioned Lynn in Afghanistan after his family had hired a lawyer for him. The questioning yielded potentially damaging admissions from Lynn that factored into his decision to later plead guilty to felony charges, which resulted in his 20-year prison sentence.
At his 2003 confirmation hearing, Michael Chertoff said he and his deputies did not play an active role in discussions about ethics warnings in the case from lawyers elsewhere in the department. But a Justice Department whistleblower tells a very different story. Jesselyn Radak was a government ethics advisor at the Department of Justice during the Lind case. She raised legal and ethical objections over the questioning of John Walker Lind without his attorney and revealed misconduct by Department of Justice officials. As a result, Jesselyn Radak's charges, she was pushed out of her job at the Justice Department, fired from her next job, put under criminal investigation, and put on a no-fly list. She joins us in the studio today, actually by telephone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us your story? What happened? Start with the Lynn case.
Basically, back when I worked for the Justice Department's Professional Responsibility Advisory Office, I happened to be the attorney on duty that day when John DePew, a prosecutor in the Terrorism and Violent Crime section, called seeking advice on having an FBI agent interrogate John Walker Lind in Afghanistan. I was advising not on the legality of interrogating him, but on the ethics of interrogating him. And under the ethics rules governing contact with a represented person, I had, as has been reflected in the public record, advised that he should not be interviewed without his counsel, and that it would be a pre-indictment custodial interview, which was not authorized by law. That was on a Friday, and then the counterterrorism prosecutor called me back on Monday to advise that the FBI had interviewed him anyway, at which point I advised that the interview might have to be sealed and only used for intelligence gathering purposes, not for criminal prosecution, which is how it, of course, ended up being used. That, however, was not my complaint. The FBI was free to disregard our advice at their own peril. My concern was that later I was given a performance evaluation that was baseless and told to find another job or else it would be placed in my permanent personnel file. I wasn't sure what was going on, but it all became clear on March 7th when the lead prosecutor in the Lind case contacted me and wanted to know if he had all of my email regarding John Walker Lind's interrogation. I explained to him that there had been more than a dozen emails, and I didn't know why he had only two. I was worried immediately that something was amiss. And basically, I went to check the file, and it had been purged of my email. So I resurrected the missing email from my computer archives with the help of technical support and gave them to my boss and promptly found another job at that point.
We're talking to Jesslyn Radak, who worked for the Justice Department and says she ultimately lost her job for raising questions of ethics in the questioning of John Walker Lind, charges directly going to Michael Chertoff, the new nominee to head the Department of Homeland Security. I'm looking at a piece in the New York Times, nomination may revisit case of citizens seized in Afghanistan. It says newly disclosed documents in the Lind case appear to conflict with assertions made to Congress by Michael Chertoff, nominated this week, about the Justice Department's handling of ethics concerns in the high-profile prosecution. At his confirmation hearing in 2003, Chertoff said he and his deputies in the criminal division did not have an active role in discussions about ethics warnings in the case from lawyers elsewhere in the department, but in previously undisclosed department documents provided to the Times by a person involved in the case who insisted on anonymity, a longtime lawyer in the division who worked under Chertoff detailed numerous contacts he had with lawyers inside and outside the division on Lind's questioning. The lawyer, John DePru, cautioned in one email message that questioning a suspect represented by a lawyer could be perceived as an ethical violation. DePru told investigators from the Inspector General's Office of the Department that his superiors were upset that he'd sought the advice of the Department's Professional Responsibility Advisory Office, or PRAO, about Lind's questioning. A supervisor, quote, informed me the criminal division's leadership was disturbed that I sought advice in that matter. And it goes on from there. It sounds similar to what you were going through.
Right. Well, basically, this just confirms what until now I could only speculate about, which was that the advice I rendered contradicted public statements that were being made by the Justice Department, in particular public statements that were being made by the Attorney General, John Ashcroft himself, about the fact that the department never believed that Lind was represented by counsel. Now, I knew for a fact that wasn't true, because it was contradicted by the advice I gave. And that led me to, I think, reasonably conclude that my emails had not reached the court, because I did not think the department would have the temerity to make public statements contradicted by its own court filings if it indeed forwarded my email to the court as had been ordered in a federal court discovery order. Why Chertoff denied during his judicial confirmation hearing that the Professional Responsibility Advisory Office had ever been consulted is beyond me. I don't know. I certainly, would not... don't feel it's my place to accuse him of perjury. I think the public record of his testimony the first time around speaks loud and clear for
itself. So I'd like to just clarify one thing. In other words, emails that you sent related to the case, a warning about the problems with this kind of interrogation, were purged, which would mean that, were purged from the file, which would mean that the defense in Lind's case would not have access to that material and would not be able then to point out in a court that the information solicited from Lind had been improperly obtained, and so in essence it was not just a question of the government initially being involved in improper questioning, but then a cover-up of that improper questioning.
Right. That was the problem I had, was with the second part you referred to, the cover-up. Basically, it was up to the judge to determine whether or not the defense would ultimately have access to the documents. But my concern was that the judge did not get all of the documents to consider in the first place. And investigative journalist Jane Mayer confirmed as much in her piece in The New Yorker, which was that the more damning of the emails, which contained the advice about not using his statements for criminal prosecution, that those emails were never submitted to the court in the original batch of submitted documents.
Jocelyn Radek, Senator Kennedy, and this is also raised in the Times piece, briefly held up Michael Chertoff's nomination last year in 2003, in part because of the questioning, saying he found some answers about the case non-responsive, evasive, and hyper-technical. A spokesperson for the department, Mark Corallo, said on Wednesday there was no inconsistency in what Mike testified to. Can you respond?
Well, my response is that in his initial testimony, Chertoff denied that the Professional Responsibility Advisory Office ever took a position on the Lind interrogation, despite the fact that his denial was contradicted by the public record, specifically articles in Newsweek magazine and in The New Yorker. And this is a direct quote by Chertoff. "I have to say, Senator, I think that the Professional Responsibility Office was not asked for advice in this matter. I was involved in it." And then he went on to say, "Mr. Lind was Mirandized, and had he requested counsel or requested to invoke his right to silence at the point at which the FBI was involved, they would have honored that request." My position is that the second part of that quote was, at best, a gross mischaracterization of what happened. And at worst, it seems like perjury. As Jane Mayer's uncontroverted article documented, the FBI agent Ryman read Lind the Miranda warning, but when noting his right to counsel, the agent acknowledged that he ad-libbed, "Of course, there are no lawyers here in Afghanistan." So then Senator Kennedy asked Chertoff a second time, "Do you remember what the Professional Responsibility Advisory Office position was on this?" And again, Chertoff said, "I was not consulted with respect to this matter. There are parts of the department that generally render opinions in this area of the law, and other expertise that was consulted." Kennedy persevered even more. Kennedy goes on to say, "Well, your statement that the Professional Responsibility Advisory Office did not have an official position on this," and Chertoff said, "I don't believe they had an official position on this." And it seemed very odd to me because I know, as the author of those emails, that the department and the Professional Responsibility Advisory Office in particular had taken an official position on this, which is confirmed by the story in the New York Times today, where not only does it indicate that the ethics office had taken an official position on this, but that the senior leadership of the criminal division, which would be Judge Chertoff, that the senior leadership was not happy with this official position and was disturbed by it, and actually went to great lengths to read and peruse and familiarize itself with those emails.
Let me ask, the problems in your case did not stop there. You were forced out of the of your job. You've had trouble finding employment in other law firms, in private law firms, and you were put on a no-fly list. Could you talk to us about that?
When I was initially forced out of my job, basically blackmailed with an unsigned, untimely, unprecedented performance evaluation, at that point, I didn't have trouble finding another job. I took another job with the law firm of Hawkins, Della Fields, and Wood, and I worked there for about 7 months. But during this time, the Justice Department told my new firm that I was under criminal investigation and that they had just hired a criminal. So at that point, because the law firm needed to maintain good relationships with the government, and because the government was leaning very heavily on the law firm to fire me, the law firm constructively discharged me by putting me on an unpaid, indeterminate leave of absence. Thereafter, there was a criminal investigation of me. It was never specified what I would be charged with, but a criminal investigation for about the next 10 months, which makes it very difficult to find a job, of course, with a cloud like that hanging over your head. And finally, when the criminal investigation concluded, ironically, on September 11th of 2003, with no charges being brought against me, they, meaning the Justice Department, immediately referred me to the state bars in which I'm licensed as an attorney. So as soon as one cloud was removed, another cloud was soon there. And basically, I feel it incumbent upon myself to tell any potential employer that I've been referred to the state bars. And understandably, a lot of law firms are reluctant to hire someone in that circumstance because it could increase their malpractice liability insurance.
So, but tell us also about this no-fly list, since Chertoff, as the new head of Homeland Security, would be in charge of these future no-fly lists as well?
Well, I hope that since the Department of Homeland Security does take charge over those terrorist watch lists, that my name would be removed. During this whole time that the criminal investigation and bar referrals were going on, I began having trouble flying on every single flight that I took. I appear to be on the selectee portion of the no-fly list, which means that I am allowed to eventually board the airplane, but I have to go through secondary security screening measures each and every time. I have complained about this to the Transportation Security Administration Ombudsman and also to the ACLU. I know I'm not the only one who is mistakenly on the list, but I hope that if I'm on it and there's no way to officially verify that, all evidence says that I am, but that I'm on it by mistake and not because I'm perceived as being some kind of political enemy.
Jesselyn Radek, on that note, we're going to have to say thanks very much and conclude this interesting discussion. Former Justice Department employee and whistleblower. That does it for today's program, Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Our website, where you can sign up for our daily headlines, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.